and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Carol Van Damme in Washington, D.C. An analyst with the Atlantic Council doubts the BRICS summit will be moved from South Africa despite ICC war crimes charges against Russian President Putin.
The ruling party and President Cyril Ramaphosa, personally, I don't think they're the constraints of their internal politics and their pride will allow them to do so. So I think the BRICS summit will take place in Johannesburg.
The main opposition leader in the DRC doesn't believe the head of the Independent Electoral Commission is up to the job and called on the international community to boycott upcoming elections.
He's saying that, I have done the audit and it's enough. We told him that that audit, you can consider it as an internal audit. How can you audit a file of 47 million people in 5 days?
And a presidential hopeful in Zimbabwe appeals a court ruling stopping him from running in the next month's election.
My campaign is going on. In fact, this kind of tactic is by the state and by the current president works in our favor because it allows the message to get to the various corners of our country much faster than maybe we could have done.
All those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South Africa could give up its role as host of this year's BRICS summit in order to sidestep international pressure to arrest Russian President Vladimir Putin, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court on charges of war crimes in Ukraine involving children. Ambassador J. Peter Pham, a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council and author of dozens of articles on African affairs, tells me in part one of our two-part interview that he thinks it's highly unusual the BRICS summit will be moved from South Africa to China.
Although it might be an elegant solution in a theoretical sense to a number of problems, both for South Africa as a country and for the political leadership of the African National Congress, the ruling party, and President Cyril Ramaphosa, personally, I don't think they're the constraints of their internal politics and their pride will allow them to do so. So I think the BRICS summit will take place in Johannesburg as scheduled August 22nd to 24th.
So if the summit is, and you think it will be, held in Johannesburg, and President Cyril Ramaphosa said it would be held in person, what's the likelihood that South Africa would arrest Putin, knowing they have quite a relationship?
Well, I think first we have to look at a couple of things. First, whether Vladimir Putin feels comfortable traveling outside Russia, given what's happened recently with the revolt, mutiny, whatever you want to call it, of the Wagner group, and the fact that it made its way, a military force, to a little more than 100 miles from Moscow unopposed. So I think there's a question of whether Vladimir Putin would want to be that far away from Russia at this time, if he feels secure enough. That's question number one. And then question number two then enters in, if he does feel secure enough to travel, would South Africa actually live up to its treaty obligations as a member of the Rome Treaty establishing the International Criminal Court? Now, it has a history of violating those obligations. Several years ago, you may recall that Omar al-Bashir, then dictator of Sudan, who was wanted by the ICC, was in South Africa, and a South African court, a domestic court, also ruled that the government was obliged to proceed against him. And despite that, it defied both its treaty obligations and its own judiciary and hustled the man out of the country. So it's highly unlikely that it would come to a confrontation.
I mean, it's hard to say, even if he would show up in person, as you're pointing out, it's hard to say that South Africa would even take any action against him if it would come to that.
Right. But what is likely, however, is irrespective of whether Vladimir Putin shows up or not, irrespective of South Africa ignores its treaty obligations or not, is the very fact of the BRICS summit, but certainly if Putin were to show up in person, underscoring again how far South Africa's foreign policy is from the interests of the United States and of other Western countries. And this is a time when South Africa's support for Russia, including permitting sanctioned individuals and vessels to arrive in South Africa, allegations of arms sales, all of which raise questions about South Africa as a viable partner leading up to the renewal of AGOA next year.
But the United States is a big trading partner with South Africa. The United States has a relationship with South Africa, too. So, you know, what is they supposed to do?
I think to date, South Africa has taken, I think, the relationship with the United States for granted. The United States is South Africa's second largest export market. Just 13% of China of exports from South Africa go to China. 12% go to the U.S. And most of that is duty-free on a concessionary basis, on the basis of South Africa being part of the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which is up for renewal next year. And as a bipartisan group of congressional leaders from both the House and the Senate, both Democrats and Republicans, recently wrote to the Secretary of State questioning South Africa being part of that arrangement. And irrespective of the review, that entire AGOA is up.
That's Ambassador J. Peter Pham, a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council. He was speaking to me this week in Washington. Zimbabwe, lawyers for independent presidential aspirant Tyson Savior Kasa-Gweere have appealed the court's decision barring him from contesting in the coming August general election. Kasa-Gweere, who denies being a member of the ruling ZANU-PF party, says although he respects the judiciary, he sharply rejects the decision of the court, which will prevent him from running. His remarks come after the electoral court disqualified Kasa-Gweere, a former senior government official, for not being in the country long enough to meet the requirements that would have allowed him to be a candidate in the election. Kasa-Gweere went into exile following the overthrow of former longtime president Robert Mugabe. The electoral law requires a candidate to have stayed in the country for at least 18 months ahead of the vote. For reaction to his disqualification and subsequent appeal, VOA's Peter Clody reached out to Tyson Savior Kasa-Gweere.
Clearly, we respect the judiciary, but we disagree completely with their findings in this case, and we have therefore initiated the process. We're on a number of grounds, including jurisdiction and so forth. We have appealed to the Superior Court, which we believe will find or will come up with differences and a different conclusion, and will find us will give us an answer that is positive in terms of our prayer.
Will this impact your ability to campaign and to contest?
My campaign is going on. In fact, this kind of tactic is by the state and by the current president. Works in our favor because it allows the message to get to the various corners of our country much faster than maybe we could have done. He has created, now there's an expectation that I must run. He has brought in, even those who might have thought differently, they now see that the system and Mnangagwa is scared of my candidature. I mean, it's just giving him sleepless nights.
What makes you think that your candidacy is giving him sleepless nights? Since analysts are saying he's going to win the election anyway, why would he be bothered with you? Some are saying he should be bothered with the biggest opposition party and not necessarily you, since you're still a member of the ZANU-PF, they said.
Well, not a member anymore. But however, with regards to his fears, that's why I'm surprised that it is only me they consider to have stayed out of the country for 18 months, let alone pursued because I grew up in the party. He knows my standing in terms of the majority membership in the party, that they'll support me any day, even though I'm an independent candidate. So that is giving him sleepless nights. He's worried about himself.
What do you say to those who are of the view that this is all part of a grand plot just to take some vote away from the opposition to pave way for the president to win the election? So they are saying just part of the ZANU-PF plot. So they are onboarded by your concerns. Your reaction?
I don't know if there's any static voter or a voter who is labeled that they belong to this part of that party. Voters exercise their right in the ballot box when they get in there. And none of us, let alone soothsayers, can tell who is going to vote for who. So that notion that I'm trying to divide or affect some people is utter nonsense.
What about those who are of the view that you don't have any structures on the ground, like the ZANU-PF, the ruling party, or the CCC, led by Mr. Nelson Chamisa, and that, you know, this is just a trial balloon for future prospects for you to contest in the future, and not necessarily any seriousness in your candidacy?
No, look, at the end of the day, the decision by the voter is done at an individual level. Let us not reinvent the wheel. It's not about structures that eventually yield the result for any party. It's about the manifesto, the programs and plans that you sell, whether they resonate with the people or not. What do you stand for? What is your track record? These are the things that will be used by voters to determine who they should vote for.
Some people have suggested that the elections will neither be free nor credible. What is your stance?
Well, because the ability of our institutions are at stake, and that's why I think it's essential that these elections are conducted in a manner that will bring about a positive a result that all of us can accept. Yes, they are concerned, and rightly so, of some of the tactics, or let alone the strange behavior that is being exhibited by authorities throughout the country. But that should not detract us, let alone should it be an excuse which we give them for them to have a right to get what they want without fighting for it. So, yes, we will keep our eyes on the ball, keep focused, and overcome exactly what you're talking about.
That's Zimbabwe independent presidential hopeful Tyson Savior Kasuguweri speaking with my colleague Peter Clody. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Saudi Arabian Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan affirmed a shared commitment to end 3 months of fighting in Sudan. The bloody conflict has caused most civilians to flee the capital region of Khartoum, Bahri, and Omdurman, and has spawned ethnically motivated attacks on civilians in the Darfur region. Efforts by the U.S. and neighboring countries have so far failed to stop the fighting. Meanwhile, the International Criminal Court Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan says a new investigation has been opened to alleged war crimes in Sudan. Allegations of atrocities have mounted during the conflict between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, who are battling for control of the country. The top UN official in Sudan called for the warring sides to be held accountable. According to the French news agency AFP, an estimated 3,000 people have been killed and 3 million more displaced since the violence erupted on April 15th. The UN has warned of possible new massacres in Darfur, saying this week the bodies of at least 87 people allegedly killed last month by the RSF and their allies had been buried in a mass grave in Darfur. The U.S. State Department welcomed the new probe, with spokesman Matthew Miller saying, "Let this be a message to all who commit atrocities in Sudan and elsewhere that such crimes are an affront to humanity." Sudanese refugees in the Lake State capital, Rumbek, are calling on aid agencies for humanitarian assistance. The refugees say they lack food, shelter, water, and medicine, among other things. The head of the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Lake State says his office has registered more than 220 Sudanese refugee households in Rumbek alone and another 900 households of Sudanese Bagari and Falata communities in another county. William Sunday Mabour has this report from Rumbek.
Abdullahi Abdullah used to reside in Khartoum Saad neighborhood before conflict broke out between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary's Rapid Support Forces in mid-April. Abdullah says when life became difficult in Khartoum, he fled with his family looking for safety. He says his journey was tough, adding that it took him and others more than a month to reach Rumbek in Lagos State.
We suffered a lot on the way. Sometimes we spent 2 to 3 days without water. Thank God we are in Rumbek now. We need some help. We say this is our second home. South Sudan is our second home. Even if we die here, it is better than to die in the forest where you will not be buried. But here, South Sudanese are our brothers.
Abdullah says although he feels safer in Rumbek, life is difficult due to lack of basic necessities. Sarah Adam Saad, another Sudanese asylum seeker, says she and other refugees are sleeping in the open over the past couple of days. She's appealing to well-wishers to help refugees overcome the challenges of settlement in South Sudan.
We are really suffering. No food, no water, so we need some help, our people. We are one people. Our children, too, are suffering. No food, and some fell sick on the way. If there are people who could help, I will appreciate.
Dud Malwal is the chairperson of the Relief and Rehabilitation Commission in Lagos State. He says his office has registered over 1,000 Sudanese in 2 counties of Lagos State. He says his office is working with the aid agencies to assess the needs of the refugees arriving daily from Sudan.
There will be a team that will come composed of UNHCR mostly, who is the in charge of refugees, and refugees commission. That team will be headed by Director General of Protection. They will be coming within these weeks, and they will assess these Sudanese refugees who are here in the lakes.
Charlotte Halvis, the UNHCR spokesperson in South Sudan, says the agency is looking for funds to support Sudanese fleeing the conflict in Sudan.
We know that the situation is not easy, and this is across the country. As I said, we're working in so many different locations because there has been a very large influx. Our emergency response right now is severely underfunded, so the response is not enough. We are aware of it. We are looking for more international funding, but as of now, we're doing our best with what we have.
According to UNHCR, tens of thousands of Sudanese have fled fighting between Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces and are seeking safety in the Central African Republic, Chad, Egypt, Ethiopia, Libya, and South Sudan. For VOA News, I am William Sande Mabour, reporting in Rumbek, Lagos State.
If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
The foreign minister of Guinea-Bissau says Nigeria will host West African regional leaders to find ways to bolster peace and stability in the region. This after the leaders agreed to meet to help military governments transition to constitutional and civilian rule. Among the participants is Susie Barbosa, who was also the president of the Minister's Council of the Economic Community of African States. She says the decision was made at the recent meeting of heads of states and government of ECOWAS in Guinea-Bissau's capital. It was the first time regional leaders had met in Bissau. President Umaro Mbalo, the former chairman of the regional bloc, handed over power to newly installed Nigerian President Bola Tinubu. To learn more about the outcome of the ECOWAS meeting and the next steps forward, VOA's Peter Clody reached Susie Barbosa in Bissau.
First of all, it was the first time ever ECOWAS had a summit meeting in Bissau. As you may know, since the beginning of this organization, even though we are member country since the beginning. It's the first time Guinea-Bissau has the chance not only to chair, but also to have a summit in Bissau. It was an extreme exit because it's the first time in the last years that all the heads of state came to the summit. This gave us the opportunity of having a very good discussion in the week, and especially the decisions made show that as a meet of all the ECOWAS countries being together, united to find a solution for the instability that concerns some of the member countries, as, for example, Mali, Guinea, and Burkina Faso. Due to this, it was decided that the new country that's going to chair is Nigeria, not only because of the great economic and financial potential of Nigeria, but also because Nigeria is a very big nation with lots of resources that may help to chair the ECOWAS.
What do you say to those who were of the opinion that perhaps ECOWAS should have waited, or the leaders should have waited a little bit since the outcome of the election is being challenged in court?
I believe that's their own opinion. What I think is the ECOWAS heads of state, they know the reality well enough to decide by unanimity that they wanted Nigeria to chair, because they more than no one know what's the reality of the ECOWAS countries. And they know that the ECOWAS, the Nigerian president, has all the conditions, even though he just came now, because it's not only him, it's the whole machine. It's the whole country that has the institutions and has people that have lots of experience in the ECOWAS. So not because the president just came doesn't mean that they're not able to chair properly the ECOWAS.
As the foreign minister, what was the major takeaway of the decisions that were made in Bissau?
As you may know, we started last week with the Minister's Council. We had the Minister's Council in the defense and security level, which I also chaired. And there the decision was to finally put in practice the interposition forces of ECOWAS that can be used not only for the terrorist attacks, but also for the instability situation of member countries. In the second Minister's Council, we also had discussions about how to implement the project of major importance in our areas, which is the road that will connect most of the countries to transport goods between our countries, and also to play to improve the commercial relations between our countries, and this way also improve the economic situation of our country. So mainly during the 3 days that work that we had before the summit, these were the main decisions. During the summits, the heads of state decided that the priority is to find solutions to the three countries that are in transition. And this is why they decided to meet again in 30 days in Nigeria to see the strategic decisions they will take in order to bring back to the normal or to the constitutional order those that are in transition.
But Ms. Barbosa, a lot of critics of ECOWAS say that brilliant ideas, lofty ideas are brought up by West African regional leaders, but implementation appears to be wobbly, and that is why there are some concerns about the weakening of democracy despite efforts to strengthen democracy in West Africa. Your take?
Well, I can tell you that for many years, ECOWAS was an example as a regional organization. We had lots of success. These last years, especially the last 2 years, we have been having this situation and instability due to the coup d'etat. First, exactly this to solve and put them to track. But many times the ideas, when we put them in action, it's not really what we want to achieve. So it may take longer, but we are going to achieve a solution. We are sure of that.
For residents of West Africa, what should they be expecting from the decisions that were made during the last ECOWAS summit in Bissau?
Especially what we would like to have is this implementation of the roadmaps that we are giving to those three countries. And exactly, we think that in 30 days, may probably all the results that we have. in order to bring these countries to have election and to have a democratic order in their countries.
That was Susie Barbosa, past president of the Minister's Council of the Economic Community of African States, speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the main opposition leader says he does not have confidence in the ability of Denis Kadima, the chairman of the Independent Electoral Commission, to administer credible polls. Martin Fayulu, who leads the Engagement for Citizenship and Development Party, is also calling on observers from the international community to boycott the upcoming December elections. The Electoral Commission has a deadline of July 17th for parties to register to take part in the vote, but opposition groups say they won't, a move analysts say will undermine the legitimacy of the polls. Fayulu's remarks come after opposition and civil society groups say the Electoral Commission refused an external audit of the voter list that would be used in the elections. They're calling for dialogue between the Electoral Commission and all stakeholders to ensure the polls are transparent and credible. VOA's Peter Clotty spoke to Fayulu about his demand for credible elections.
We cannot let Mr. Kadima and the Electoral Commission to go ahead and commit another electoral fraud because he doesn't want to audit the electoral file by an external body. And we cannot just have a confidence on what he has done. Mr. Kadima is saying that, I have done the audit and it's enough. We told him that that audit, you can consider it as an internal audit. How can you audit a file of 47 million people in 5 days? Okay, now, if you did that, okay, up to you. But let us, with you, choose a body that is recognized as auditors, experts, international experts, and independent, then they will come and sit down, including ourselves. All the stakeholders should be there as observer to see what is going on. He doesn't want.
Are the other opposition political parties supporting your stance at the moment? Because next week, July 17th, will be the deadline to register to participate in the December elections.
For me, we will not have an election in this country if we don't have a clean electoral file. I will tell Congolese, don't go to that election because it will be a rigged election, is a prearranged election, but we are requesting for the impartial and credible election, transparent election. That's what we want. We are telling all friends of Congo, all partners, they have to come to help us, and we can sit down together as stakeholders and agree on the rule of the game, what we can do to have a transparent and impartial election.
It looks like the Electoral Commission chairman, CNE chairman, is not listening to your demands. So what's next for you? You are calling on the international community to pressure them. What can the international community do?
No, not only the international community. I'm telling the Congolese people that they cannot accept the first responsibilities lie on the Congolese people. Because our the constitution says in Article 64 that every Congolese has the right and the obligation to stop anyone who wants to take power by force or to exercise power by violating our constitution. I'm telling first to the Congolese people, they cannot consider that the incoming election has a credible election. So they have to refrain themselves to the process. Then saying that we are still available, we still want a clean process like
In 2016, when we had the problem, the president of Congo Brazzaville, President Denis Sassou Nguesso, called the bishops, the Congolese bishop, and they went to Brazzaville and they came back and they put all of us together. And the majority of that time and the opposition, we sat down and then we signed an agreement, an accord on December 30th, 2016. We signed that. And
so, Mr. Fayulu, for you, what is the next step forward?
The next step is all international observers, European, American, African, all of them, they have to withdraw to this process to say that there is a lack of confidence, the lack of transparency. And then you Congolese, you have to resolve the issue, your issue, and as the stakeholders, sit down and go for the transparency process and put together the rule of the game, and so you can go ahead. But for the time being, we don't want people to go to tell us that, okay, democracy is a process, is something that you have to grow. But we are not growing in our democracy.
That's DRC main opposition leader Martin Fayulu speaking with my colleague Peter Clody. Government representatives have declined to comment on the opposition's allegations other than to dismiss them as politics. The United States and other embassies in the DRC have reiterated their commitment to supporting the DRC in holding competitive, peaceful, inclusive, and transparent elections. In a joint statement issued last month, they noted concerns regarding technical shortcomings, incidents of official corruption, and the diversion of electoral material. They also acknowledged that CENI and other authorities have responded to those challenges. They urged CENI to act with transparency to address public concerns. Are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Sierra Leone, the main opposition All People's Congress Party says its elected lawmakers will continue to boycott parliament until all of its demands are met. The party says it will not participate in the country's governance for the next 6 months before it will make a decision about its next steps forward. Attorney Osman Abdul Timbo, an elected member of parliament and deputy national secretary general of the APC, says the failure of the Electoral Commission to publish the results despite repeated appeals bolsters the party's suspicions that the recent elections were not credible. His remarks come after the U.S. ambassador to Sierra Leone urged the APC not to boycott legislative and local governance. The opposition demands fresh polls, citing voter irregularities and rigging. It also comes after a majority of APC lawmakers refused to attend the induction ceremony to take their oaths of office. For more, VOA's Peter Clody reached attorney Osman Abdul Timbo.
Key amongst these demands is that to conduct a rerun of the elections within 6 months, because we are not satisfied with the election results, and we are not just dissatisfied out of nothing. We believe that the numbers were cooped. We believe that until the disaggregated results per polling stations are published, which they should be able to publish by this time, they should have published by this time, the elections cannot be said to be credible. I don't know if you are aware of the history and a demands or complaints right through or leading up to the elections and even during the elections and the tally of the results. We had catalogued all of our demands, we've catalogued all of our complaints since the start of the process, right up to the date the elections, the results were announced.
Well, we had reports that the U.S. ambassador calling on the APC not to boycott governance. Sierra Leone, what is your reaction to?
We're saying, how can you say the voices of those people should be heard when in the first place we believe that the election results don't reflect the voice and the votes of the people? Our people, the people who we're representing, don't forget we're only representatives. The people who we're representing have told us not to participate. Not one person have I, as an MP elect, not one person who has called me to talk to me about going or not going to parliament has reached out to me telling me to go to parliament. Everyone I've spoken to outside the party's decision aside has told me not to go to parliament until a demands are met. The U.S. ambassador said it's for the sake of democracy. Democracy is not just a word. We should be seen to be practicing democracy. We should be seen to be doing what democracy dictates. We don't believe that what the elections that the ECSL, the Electoral Commission, announced is a true reflection of the democratic will of the people.
What are the two key or major demands by the APC in order to participate in the governance of the country, or so to speak, to allow the voice of the people who voted for you to be heard?
We'll just put all together and just say one. Publish the disaggregated results per polling station. It's only 11,000 polling stations. And like I said this morning in a post that I did on Facebook, we're saying if you announce final results, those results are based on the addition of results per polling stations. And that's what should be a reflection of the total of those votes on the polling stations. So if you've announced a total result, that means you have the results from the polling stations from which you calculated the total. So it should not take more than a day for you to publish that. But it's over 3 weeks now, and we're still asking for this, and I'm sure international observers as well as local observers have been asking for this, and up till this day, they haven't done that. I'm pretty sure if that is done, then those who are doubting the credibility of this result will be proven right or will be proven wrong. So that's amongst all the demands, to make it very simple, let them publish the disaggregated results per polling station.
What do you say to those who are saying that there are laid down procedures, if you disagree with the outcome of an election, to approach the court to address your concerns?
In the past 5 years, we've expressed a dissatisfaction by going to court. We have boycotted parliamentary sittings. We've had a few grandstandings before. What have we gained from all of those? Nothing. So we've seen that all of that hasn't yielded any good. So we say now we're holding a right to participate based on the instruction from our electorate, the people who voted for us.
So how long do you plan on boycotting parliament or participating in the governance of the country?
Well, in a press release, we demanded that a re-run be conducted within 6 months, meaning that we don't even mind staying out for 6 months. Until that 6 months expires, then we'll know what our next line of action will be.
That was attorney, APL official, and member of parliament, Osman Abdel Timbo. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Clody. Day after three Libyan oil fields were closed, the oil ministry late Friday called on all parties involved in recent accidents to set energy production and export away from disputes. The oil fields were shut down in protest over the abduction of a former finance minister.
The closures will hurt the marketing of Libyan oil and undermine efforts that have been made to stabilize production, according to the ministry statement. Production at Libya's El Feel, Shahrara, and 108 oil fields were closed on Thursday in a protest by the Alzawi tribe, according to a tribal leader. Today in Senegal, Senegalese opposition leader Ousmane Sonko called for a peaceful protest after authorities blocked a planned rally to publicly confirm his nomination as a candidate in upcoming presidential elections. On Thursday, the PASTEF Patriots Party said in a statement that Sonko was unanimously voted in as their candidate for the February 25, 2024 presidential elections. Sonko's nomination comes despite lingering questions over his eligibility due to criminal convictions and prison sentences. The governor of Dakar announced on Thursday the opposition party's nomination rally, initially scheduled for Saturday afternoon in a stadium on the outskirts of the capital, had been banned due to the risk of disturbing public order. Sonko told his supporters another date would be chosen and called for a concert of saucepans, horns, and firecrackers on Saturday evening between 8:30 and 9 p.m. local time to peacefully express disapproval and call for President Macky Sall to leave office in peace. Sonko, who has been confined by security forces at his home in Dakar since May 28, also urged his supporters to wear red in protest. On May 8th, an appeals court gave Sonko a six-month suspended term for slander, although it's unclear whether the sentence, which can also be appealed to the Supreme Court, makes him ineligible. On June 1st, Sonko was also given a two-year sentence following a trial on charges of sexual abuse of a beauty salon worker. Legal analysts and Sonko's own lawyers say his conviction rules him out from being a candidate. A Cameroonian youth-led organization, Local Youth Corner, is working to address violent extremism across the Central African nation through their annual Jamboree, an eight-week-long summer program geared at promoting peace and healthy living. VOA's Mike Hove has more.
The Jamboree, an initiative pioneered by the youth group in partnership with several international embassies, United Nations organizations, and local agencies, targets thousands of internally displaced persons as beneficiaries and will run through August 30. A statement released during the launch of the second annual Nawiwi Sports Jamboree says the organization uses sports as a tool to build social cohesion, promote peace and healthy living between and among IDPs from the Northwest and Southwest regions and host communities in Cameroon. The executive director of Local Youth Corner, Achaleke Christian Leke, says the Jamboree equips IDPs with the appropriate skills to better address displacement resulting from conflict.
Through the recreational nature of the Jamboree, it is helping to respond to mental health and psychosocial issues that this group of persons are facing because of the realities of either running away from conflict and some of the challenging things that they have experienced.
Mr. Leo, an award-winning Cameroonian musician, IDP, and participant of the first Jamboree, echoes Leke's sentiments.
These people, because of the war, most of them lost everything. So they find themselves in an environment where they can barely cope. And a lot of them are going through depression because of what's happening.
Canada's High Commissioner to Cameroon, Lorraine Anderson, attended the launch of the Sports Jamboree, where she applauded efforts by Cameroonian youth to attain peace and social cohesion.
It's really important to use all mechanisms to support peace and social cohesion. And it's clear that the collaboration, the fun, the communication that's needed for team sport is also needed for social cohesion.
Philip Van Damme, the European Union ambassador to Cameroon and a participant of the games presented by the Local Youth Corner, says lessons taken from the Jamboree should be promoted all year round.
Sport can unite, that regardless of our background, linguistic, ethnic, religious, whatever, we can play together, we can live together, we can work together, we can build a nation together.
Cameroon's northwest and southwest regions have been victim to conflict since 2017 after confrontations began between security forces and separatists who declared an English-speaking state of Ambazonia. The ongoing conflict has resulted in widespread atrocities, the displacement of over 598,000 people, and at least 2 million people in desperate need of humanitarian aid. Challenges the Sports Jamboree looks to address. For VOA Africa, I'm Mike Ove in Washington.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. We hope you enjoy what we have for you today.
She wants to circle me back on the end zone. Bad man, I go so from long way, I cut off the link. She left a message in a DM, master go band man from AM to PM. She can't forget about the things when me gear.
When me shape up the beat, shape up the beat, yeah.
Somebody tell her, oh Isabella, me I no be Mandela. You turned up as where you take Angela. Right, I know what she has spent my pounds and dollar. Spaghetti, yeah, yeah. Spaghetti, yeah, yeah.
Grab my phone, checking on my Insta. Everything go, so my shorty with another bro. Oh my goodness, she's a hoe.
I don't know what you wanna hear from me.
Thinking about the way it's really for me.
But you be on my mind constantly. Where your conscience,
baby, my love, go by me, by me.
I will take you overseas.
Me and you for be like privacy.
You knocking me down with your crematize.
Why would I feel intoxicated? Shawty just be looking for the picture. I feel like love is overrated, oh. Cause tell me why you got me so, so wasted. So faded, oh. I feel intoxicated. Shawty just
if the family's got along, Chinedu, tell me what we gonna do, huh? Life comes at you fast, see you on holiday, only snap one glass, one view, thought your friends would come too. Tell me why I'm seeing your girls in London, got me in a pickle, a little conundrum. I don't wanna make assumptions, I called you, why you gonna text me? It's better you kill me, better you arrest me. Bad man stress, woman a woman, nothing stress me. You could've taught me, see the way you test me. See the way social media so cold. Love's easy to find, harder to hold. Most stories end and start with a phone. Although with them in Lade, she was half of my home. Oxley, you know my girl, Denise, the year younger than men from East. She got the tribal mark and she used to be friends with peace. Won't let me know peace, she want chop my gari and peas. It's what I'm looking if I'm headed to the streets. That's why I'm intoxicated like what these girls want from her.
I don't know what you wanna hear from me.
Thinking about
the way it's really
for me.
But you be on my mind constantly.
Where your conscience,
baby, my love go by me, by me.
I will take you overseas.
Me and you for be like privacy.
You knocking me down with your crematize.
Why would I feel intoxicated? Shawty just be looking for the picture. I feel like love is overrated, oh. Cause tell me why you got me so, so wasted, so faded. I feel intoxicated. Shawty just
Was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 1600 and 1800 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Hove, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. I'm your host, Carol Van Dam, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.